Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, and welcome to Runners Only with Dom Harvey, brought to you by Radix Nutrition. Coming up, Cam Jones.
Just as we're about to hang up, he said, "Oh, just remember, always be a leader, never be a follower." And then for the first time since I was a kid, he said, "I love you and I'm proud of you."
Cameron Jones is a New Zealand actor. If you're an old fan of Shortland Street, you might remember him from that. He cut his teeth as Dallas Jones, the ambulance driver on Shorties, 10 years ago. He's done heaps of other work too. He was in the Hobbit movies, a Christmas movie with Dolly Parton. And he has a brand new movie called Home Kills, which has been showing and getting rave reviews as part of the New Zealand Film Festival. I didn't know much about Cam prior to this conversation. I've interviewed him a couple of times before back in the Shortland Street days on the radio show. But I learned so much during this conversation. What his dad thought about his career choice as an actor. Spoiler alert, wasn't great. And then the final conversation he had with his dad before his dad passed away. We touch upon the stress of trying to break into the LA acting scene, the bizarre thing that he got offered thousands of dollars to do, his struggles with his mental well-being, and much, much more. It was Bridget Smith, a mutual friend of ours, that suggested I get Cam on as a guest, and he did not disappoint. I thoroughly enjoyed getting to know a bit more about him, and I really believe you guys will too. Thanks very much to Radix Nutrition for sponsoring this episode. If you don't have protein as part of your daily diet, you should start ASAP. Protein helps you gain muscle, if that's your goal, or to just keep the muscle you already have. This becomes more and more important as you age. I start every single day with a protein shake made with protein powder from Radix. They honestly do the best flavors made with the best ingredients. They've just introduced two new flavors to their range, mango and also blueberry. And like all the other flavors in their range, these two do not disappoint. Check out their incredible range of nutritional products at radixnutrition.co.nz. That's R-A-D-I-X. All right, let's get into the episode. Cam Jones on Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Just want to connect for everyone who loves running. Hey, Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Runners Only with Dom Harvey and Cam Jones. G'day, mate.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Mate, thanks so much for coming over. You come here highly recommended by a mutual friend of ours.
Oh, wow, thank you very much. It's an honour, mate.
So how are you?
I'm good. Yeah. Wow, you know, all things considered, I'm alive. That counts for something, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, so, that doesn't sound great.
Oh, well, you know, you're just realistic, mate. It can always be better. It's not, you know, it could be worse, but it could be better, always.
Mm. But you chose this life.
I did.
It was never
going to
be easy.
Yeah, I did. No. It is a fine line between drive and insanity. But and I walk that tightrope very, very carefully.
Actually, I got a message from a friend of mine who you have worked with. I'll read this out and we'll see if you can guess who it is.
Okay.
The second half is quite telling. The first half might be a little bit generic. Oh, Cam, what a truly lovely guy. We were all so struck by his gorgeous looks, lovely nature, and professionalism and talent. Couldn't fault him. Any ideas? That could be anyone at that point, right? Dolly Parton?
Wow, was it? Yeah, far out. May well be.
Okay, I'll keep going then.
Yeah.
I did do something silly. I walked in on him as he was doing his diabetes, and I made it so awkward, and I wouldn't stop talking about it or asking him questions about it. And then I sang him happy birthday, in part to shut myself up, in part because I think it truly was his birthday. Anyway, awesome guy. I look forward to hearing the chat. Any idea?
Is this an actor or is this a crew?
Actor.
And it's an actor.
Oh, come on. This can't have happened more than once.
Oh, it actually has happened quite a few. I mean, I haven't had happy birthdays, but a lot of people walked in on me awkwardly and then they don't know how to deal with me, you know, doing my diabetes, you know, but I can't.
Okay, I'll put you out of your misery. Anna Hutchison, who you were in the movie A Love Yarn with Netflix movie.
That's right, yeah.
So the diabetes.
The The diabetes, yeah.
Right. So when were you diagnosed?
I was 15, and I was diagnosed. I was actually kind of cottoned onto it a little bit earlier than most people would, because I had a 50cc scooter at the time, and I was doing wheelies on it, as you do when you're 15. And I fell off, and I banged up my leg pretty bad, and I got a really bad blood infection from that. And then I just collapsed in the shower one day from the blood infection. I just thought they were pimples, but, you know, blood infection. So it was pretty bad. Got taken to hospital, and then at hospital they did all the tests, and they're like, oh, something's not quite right with your HbA1c, and might have to come back for some more tests. And so went back for some more tests, and they're like, oh, you've got type 1 diabetes. So, yeah, it all happened from there. And, yeah, hard age to do it, because I was, you know, 15, you're just starting to get into drinking and to girls and, you know, so I was and partying and all that kind of stuff. So it was hard.
It's a lot. It must have felt like the end of your world at that.
It did. Yeah, I didn't even know what it was.
Yeah.
So I literally didn't even know what it was. I was like, what is it? And what does this mean? And blah, blah. And does this affect me in any way? And I mean, it does on a daily basis. But yeah, it was just so, left field, you know, like I was just like, I didn't know anyone with it. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what to expect. So I was just, I think even my parents and myself were just all, didn't know what to do. You know, it was just so, just learning to create a habit out of things and stay on top of it. But man, it was a hard age to deal with it. And
yeah, and a lot of responsibility at that age as well.
Yeah.
Like, say you're the age you are now and you get diagnosed. You're like, okay, yeah. I need to inject myself with insulin these times. But at 15, it's like, fuck, it's a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
That must have been depressing.
It was, yeah. And to be honest, like, it still is, and it's still, you know, I've been pretty disciplined. The one thing I was never in denial of it, which is, you know, when I talk to like diabetic nurses and people at the hospital and stuff, they say a lot of the problems with young kids is that they just don't do anything because they're in denial, and so they just won't inject, and they just don't want to believe that they've got it. And so for whatever reason, I never did that, and I was pretty, like, I always wanted to try and stay on top of it. But even when you're doing your best, it's there's so much out of your control, you know, like so much affects it, you know, stress affects it, exercise affects it, like your moods, if, you know, everything can raise or lower your blood sugar and stuff. So it's still hard, and that's the thing. I try to be honest with people or parents when they come up to me and they say, hey, my kid's been diagnosed with diabetes and he's struggling with it, you know, do you have any advice? I'm like, to be honest, it doesn't really get easier, and it's still hard for me now, like I still struggle with it, but the important thing is just to do your best, I guess, and not let it take over your life. Because that's the other thing, is like, my control's not perfect, but at the same time, I would have perfect control if I lived in my house every day and just did nothing, and yeah, you know, I fucking did the same thing every day.
It's not a life though,
is it? But there's no quality of life there. So like, you've got to find a little balance. But I'm also not reckless, and I'm not, you know, out, you know, partying every night or every week, and, you know, and letting, yeah. So it's, so you've just got to be a little bit smart about it.
So what does it mean exactly in terms of like diet and like what alcohol can you drink or can't you drink? Can you have clean spirits?
So if I drink, I'll usually, I mean, I drink, like, vodka is obviously the best and it's the cleanest. But it's not the, people always think it's the sugar and the alcohol. That's not the issue. It's, the issue is that when you're drinking alcohol, your liver prioritizes filtering the alcohol over filtering food. So when you're getting drunk, your liver's now working in overtime to process all the alcohol, and so whatever food you're having is not getting processed. So that's where it's dangerous, because you might have a high reading and be like, oh, fucking, so you inject for that. But actually it's a false reading, because once that liver stops processing the alcohol at 3 a.m., it's now going to start processing the food. So now you're in double insulin, you know. So that's where it gets a bit dangerous, and people get into trouble with, you know, that with heavy drinking and stuff. But diet wise, no, I eat everything and anything, you know. And I've got a real, I'm a big burger and sandwich person. And I don't let it.
Come on. By the way, this it's not just an audio podcast. People can watch this as well. No one's going to believe that. Look at you.
I do.
You got leading mate, man a, good looks.
No. I train hard to be able to eat the sandwiches and the burgers, but.
People say that to me. They're like, you can't run away from a bad diet. And I'm like, if you run fucking far enough, really you actually can.
Yeah. It's a catch 22. I train for the food and I eat the food because I train. Yeah. So it's like, I've done a course where like a carb counting course. So I know exactly what I can kind of to my best assume how much carb is, you know, are in a certain food. And, I mean, eating out's always hard because I don't know for sure, but generally I have a pretty good idea of what I'm eating, and then I can inject based on that. Sometimes hit or miss, but, like, I've got a pretty – so I can eat anything, really, because I know the carb – as long as I know the carb content, I'm fine.
Well, it seems like you coexist with it quite successfully.
I try, yeah.
How long has it been now? So you got it when you were 15?
Yeah, 32 now. 32.
Sorry, so seven, yep. You've had it for longer than what you haven't had it.
Yeah.
When did the acting start? Because your first foray into acting, it was you're in rural Hawke's Bay.
That's right.
It was a school production where you played a homosexual Muslim.
Yeah, that is right. Yeah.
What was going on? At my school, we did Bugsy Malone every year. play was this?
Yeah, it was a play called A Bridge Over Troubled Waters, I think it was.
Right. Or something. It seems something like a complex.
It was a
play. A high school
play. It was
a play.
Dark play. Yeah. It was a very dark play, actually.
So this is pre diabetes or just sort of after?
This
around
is
around the same time.
Probably around the same time. Yeah. Maybe afterwards. I think I was 16, maybe a little bit into it.
Was that the leading role?
No, they were kind of. It followed a few different. It was kind of like that Angels in America kind of feel, where it kind of followed a few different characters and things and a few different storylines. It's actually a beautiful play. I'd love to read it again, you know. But it followed a few different storylines, and one of those storylines was this gay Muslim, and obviously there's a bit of a conundrum there with religion and the sexuality. Sure. And. At 16, you're like, you know, like you say, you know, like most of the school plays are really basic and really,
Bugsy
you know,
Malone, like, yeah, you every
do,
year.
You do the musical or the, you know, whatever. So to get hit with that, you know, when he cast it, and hats off, you know, props to the drama teacher though for
doing something
for doing something like different. That, because you know that is, you know, that's a lot to put on the kids, but it also they'll sink or swim and for whatever reason, I don't know why. I mean, at that point, I was only taking drama to get out of other subjects. So I was actually drama was a bit of a piss take up until that point for me, and it was just a way to muck around. And I never, I've always thought drama is like improv and theatre, sports and things, and so I never thought it was a serious thing. And then for whatever reason, it just flipped a switch on me, and I went because obviously there was, especially as a young boy, there was a to play a homosexual, there would always be a tendency to play the camp or to play
to camp it up
and be funny and try and be funny and try and, you know, because you're at high school, so you're trying to get laughs and all that kind of thing. And
you want your mates to know.
Yeah,
I suppose there was elements of homophobia even back then. So you want your mates to know that you're not gay.
Yeah, well, yeah, especially at my school, in my town, you know. So. But for whatever reason, I just really wanted to do the character justice. I just had this kind of like light bulb moment where I really wanted to walk in those shoes and present it as truthfully with integrity as I could. And I'm not sure what spurred that, but I just did. And then from there, I just, you know, I don't know if I nailed it or not, but I really struggled. I mean,
did you must have had feedback though from some people.
Yeah. Well, after that, the drama teacher was really impressed, and I started getting, you know, more, you know, good, you know, roles and productions and things like that. And then I got cast as a lead the next year for The Crucible, which is a more mainstream kind of drama show. But I think he actually did it to see if I could challenge myself or rise up to that. And I'm so glad he did. So, yeah, thank you to him. But it really just awoke something in me that I go, oh, there's actually a really beautiful element of storytelling and the ability to to give justice to people in the world and to different aspects of life and to do something that's so outside of my comfort zone and of what I know. And that takes and that forces you to really dive into that and to really respect the source material and what you're looking at.
Would you describe yourself as a perfectionist? Or was it just like a really good drama teacher that you wanted to do a good job
for? No.
Right.
I had really bad OCD as a kid and growing up as a teenager and stuff. So I was always a perfectionist with things. So I always wanted to do things to the best ability, which drives me insane, which is probably why I'm still doing it, because I'm just borderline insane. So I think that helped as well.
God, I'm like that with elements, and I try and call myself out when I do it, because it's not always healthy, right, to be a perfectionist.
No,
you need to like sometimes just relax and try and enjoy things for what they are. So there's that school production, and then so that sort of lights a fire in you. Is that when? What did you want to do for a career before up until that point?
I wanted to be a politician.
Did you?
Yeah. I wanted to be an MP.
Really?
Well, yeah, because I was...
But that is... How bizarre.
Yeah, well, I loved...
So you, when you were like 13, 14, 15?
Yeah. When I was... From 12. In intermediate, I was... When we were doing these, like, career things, I was... I put down on this board and we had to write all about our profession and stuff. It was all about MPs and I think at the time I was really... I loved Winston Peters. And so I had this whole thing about Winston Peters and I loved it because I loved public speaking. I'd always do speech competitions. I'd win speech competitions. I did debating. I was a captain of the debating team. Loved arguments and general knowledge and all that kind of stuff. So I think MP I was just like, man, I want to get into politics. And then towards the end of high school, still kind of wanted to do it, but I became, I just like, man, that's such a, I don't know where to start, but I started getting more into business, and I think I wanted to do property, so I wanted to get a Bachelor of Property at Auckland Uni by end of high school kind of thing.
Was it a political household, like political debates around the dinner table? And
not really. Very involved.
It's just a bizarre thing for a teenager to be interested in.
My dad was very into politics, and he was very smart and very knew everything about all the politicians and the history of New Zealand politics and stuff. So I think he was very well informed with general knowledge and current events. And so I think naturally I just kind of tried to emulate that a little bit and try and get myself more involved in that.
Would you ever, I suppose it's one of those doors that's always open if that's a path you want to go down. Would you ever want, you could act now. To be a politician.
Isn't that what a politician does? I don't know.
That Cam, he seems like a nice guy, but is he just acting?
Exactly. I mean, Arnie's a politician. You got
Reagan. He was before your time, but US president.
Ronald Reagan. You're obviously more controversial. Trump, so you got all these colourful characters getting into politics. So maybe, I don't know. Maybe New Zealand needs it. I don't know.
Yeah. So after doing that that play, is that when you're like, this is it? This is my destiny. This is what I want to do.
There wasn't that moment, but it was definitely when I was like, oh man, this is actually really cool. This was a profound experience for me. And I walked away learning a lot, and I walked away really understanding a lot more about myself in a weird way, and other people, And so from that, and then there was other going through high school. So that was probably fifth form, and then sixth form was The Crucible, and seventh form was a musical, I think. And I was still like, well, because, I was in Hawke's Bay, so, like, nobody thinks about getting into acting as a career. So I was always like, oh, well, it's probably just a hobby, and naturally my parents like, it's a good hobby. And then by the end of high school, I did the scholarship drama, and I got there, and I thought, well, maybe I should give this a crack. Like, maybe there's an opportunity to do something with this. And then took a year off, went down to Wellington, worked in some theatre companies, did a few shows down there, and then I was like, I'm going to audition for Toi Whakaari, which is the New Zealand Drama School.
Right.
And back then it was quite a prestigious, and it was hard to get into.
Intake of like 12 a year.
It was an intake of 20, and they had 300 odd plus audition each year, and so I went, okay, well, I'm a big believer in you. Like, my favorite quote is by Julius Caesar, is let the die fly, you know? And
let the die fly.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Before he crossed the Rubicon, he said to all his commanding soldiers and stuff, they were about to cross the Rubicon River, and his right-hand man basically said to him, look, once we cross the Rubicon River, we're committing treason and it's an act of civil war. And he just says, yeah, obviously in Latin, and he goes, let the die fly, let the chips fall where they may.
Mm.
And so, like, he's prepared himself up to that point. And so once he crosses, it's up to the fate and his preparation and a little bit of luck to see the outcome. Obviously, there was a good outcome for him. But I just love that idea, is you prepare yourself as much as possible. You get to a point and you just go, let's see what happens. Because sometimes it doesn't work, and sometimes it does. Mm. It's nice. And so that was the point. I just went, it's taking calculated risks, you know, and that's what it was. And so I think for me, it was like, well, I'm doing pretty well at this drama thing. And
well, but just by the fact that you got into Toi Whakaari, 300 apply and 20.
Well, yeah, well, I, you know, up until, well, just with school production. Right. And then, so I was like, well, if I get into Toi, I'm gonna take this seriously as a career, and I'm gonna do this as a career. If I don't, then it would be a hobby, and I'll go up to Auckland and I'll do a bachelor property. You know,
so how long's that course though?
3 years.
3 years. Yeah. Okay, so it's not an insignificant amount of time.
No. No, and it was hard training.
Like, yeah, was it?
8 to 5 every day, Monday to Friday. It wasn't like uni, like, you know, we had your movement classes, your voice classes, then your acting classes, then specialist classes. So we worked with a lot of different forms of theatre, you know, mask, mime, commedia dell'arte. So there was then screen work, obviously. Then we did dance, you know, ballet, jazz. It was a really intense program, but man, it was beautiful. It was like an incubation. And it was really the most creative 3 years of my life, really.
Didn't one of the tutors there tell you that you should try stage management?
No, that was actually the drama teacher at high school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. When I told him that I was auditioning for, that I wanted to audition for Toi, because he actually had a top drama student, this girl Nikki. And she always won the drama awards, always won those, blah, blah, blah. And she, it was always her and then me. But, like, he loved her and, like, loved, you know, like, she was the star child. And I was like, oh, I'm thinking of auditioning for Toi. And he was like, maybe you should just do the management course there. And I was just like, man, I can't wait to
fuck you.
Yeah, yeah, it was. I was like, fuck you. I went back. They asked me to come back at one point. This is probably when I was on Shorty, and I went back and I was like, and I told everyone, I was like, yeah, and Mr. Walton said that I shouldn't do the acting course. And so it was and he even admitted, he's like, yeah, I'm really sorry about that. I was like, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the most earnest, I guess, form of motivation, but if haters are your motivators, whatever it takes, exactly. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, nothing motivates me more than a fucking doubter, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Is that just how you're wired?
Yep.
Someone tells you you can't do something, and you're like, "Well, fuck
yeah, 100%. Yeah, okay. I'm a dog with a bone. Like,
yeah,
yeah.
Oh, good shit. And you mentioned some of the things before that they teach you. So, what is mask? I know what mime is and commedia dell'arte. Did you say
commedia dell'arte? Clown. Yeah. Right. So mask and clown are two kind of forms. Mask work is a pretty old school theatre form, but it's. When it's done well, when it's done properly, it's absolutely beautiful. Like, I wish there was more kind of theatre where we could see some more mask work and things. But Jacob Raji does he does mask work. His show that he just did he does incredible mask work. He's one of the masters of New Zealand, you know, for mask work.
But do you wear like a literal mask or no?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
So the whole. You would be surprised, like, clown you think is just, you know,
a clown.
Like, you don't think that it's a but there's a full form to it, and it's once you really appreciate the art, it's actually really beautiful to watch. Like, our first class for clown was, we just literally just sat in a circle and everybody had to get up one at a time, and your goal, you couldn't sit down until every single person in the class laughed. So there were some people out there, we had people crying. because they were up there for so long and they couldn't make everybody laugh, and they just started
tears of frustration.
Tears, genuine tears, not of happiness. But it's really hard, you know. You have the red nose on, and you're It's actually really cool. But it just teaches you a different way of looking at theatre forms, and it brings it right back to the origins of acting, really.
And then what came first after that? Was it Shortland Street or The Hobbit? Because you're in two of The Hobbit movies, right?
Yeah, I did Hobbit while I was at Toy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Because, yeah, so the cast director, Miranda, she came to Toy to do a workshop with us on casting, and from there she asked if I'd like to be in The Hobbit. And so
right.
That was an awesome opportunity.
Anyone that's seen the Hobbit, would they recognise you or better spot you in it or no?
I don't think so. No,
but
no,
was it must have been a good experience at that age though.
Great experience. Yeah, yeah. Like I mean, to be on that set for 2 weeks, you know, it was like, you know, and see, because I was playing through Angel's Lieutenant, who's the Elf Lord, who's played by Lee Pace, and just because I had to stand next to him in every scene that he was in, and so he was obviously acting with, you know, Sir Ian McKellen and Luke Evans and those the other top billings, and so to watch them work and just watch them working on this massive multi-million-dollar set and see Peter Jackson, and like, you know, for a drama student, I was just like, this is the best school ever. Like, this is incredible, and I was getting paid. Mm. And the catering was the best thing I've ever had. Like, I was eating noodles at night as a student, you know, and they had like fresh salmon and blah, 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 you know. So they had, it was just, I was just like, whoa, this is nuts. And just to see the scale of it, like, I was like, I've never seen anything like it. You know, the amount of extras and the amount of people, crew, and the sizes of the sets. I was just like, man, this is just beautiful. And man, that just really got me hooked. I was like, oh, I want to do this. Mm. This is awesome. You know, playing make-believe, like bow and arrows. I was just like, this is cool. This is awesome. How could you not want to just play with swords and bow and arrows and pretend you're an elf chasing after dwarves or whatever? You know, it's just like, this is just a dream come true.
Yeah, but like one of the most expensive movies ever made. Yeah. Like, it's a false sort of reality.
Yeah, it was really going from drama school production to the hot.
Yeah, like, I could get used to this. Yeah,
awesome, though. But it was awesome to see that extreme. You know, awesome to see what that end of the spectrum was. So yeah, best opportunity I could have ever had at that age at that point. Yeah.
Did you get to pick anyone's brains or have any conversations with anyone that you respected? You're just keeping your head down.
I had a small conversation with Sir Ian McKellen, because he had actually come to Toy and spoke to us, and so I kind of just said, hey, I'm Cam, and you actually came in. I think it was like weeks before, and I was like, hey, you know, you came and visited us and blah, blah, blah. And he's so friendly. Like, he's the nicest guy. So he was all chats, but like, I was very nervous being around everybody else. Like, Lee Pace, you know, I had a little conversation, but it was, it's so nervous. And they've got 100 people dealing with, you know, they've got hundreds of people coming up to them all the time. But I think the coolest thing was watching Luke Evans, because he's a pretty big dude and works out and stuff. And he had a guy. He had someone who was coming to set to him with his protein shake between takes. Like, he, so, you know, just a job, just to bring him a protein shake. I was like, that is so cool.
Oh my God, you made it
when someone brings you your protein shake between takes. I was like, that's when you know you've done it.
I mean, you're a protein shake guy. The worst thing about it is having to clean your own fucking blender afterwards. Imagine that. Someone else cleaning the blender.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, those were the goals. Yeah.
But you don't get told in those environments, like on day one, like, okay, don't fuck with Peter Jackson. Don't talk to this person. Don't take any photos. Or is it just go without saying?
No, you get told. Yeah. Because they've got that. I mean, obviously, massive confidentiality issues. But you get told. But also, you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be that person that's like,
yeah, it's kind of schmucky,
leaking stuff, or you know, trying to schmooze. Or I've always found that difficult. Like that line between genuinely trying to connect with someone in the industry and schmoozing. Like, I've always found that hard, because I never wanted to come across as schmoozing or trying to butter someone up, which is very hard in the industry. Yeah, so I try and keep pretty real. Yeah.
So then you eventually make your way to Shortland Street, where the catering's not as good.
Still
better than 2 minute noodles, though.
Still good.
So you were Dallas Adams, Ambo driver. So this is like 2013 to 2015.
Yep.
I feel like this was there's been like drastic changes in free-to-air TV between like now and then,
yep.
Yeah, like 10 years. I feel like this was a time where it was still like a massively popular show. And yep. If you're on that show, you're massively famous. Yep. How did your life change being on Shortland Street?
Pretty big.
Yeah?
Yeah, pretty like big.
Round Auckland, or do you, especially no, when you got out of Auckland to the region? I would
say less Auckland, more everywhere else. Yeah. You know, like it was almost like the smaller the town, the bigger it was. It did change completely, and I don't know if I was fully ready for that, because it's like outside of New Zealand, no one knows it or knows who you are, but like it's so intensely, it's almost it's really a pop culture phenomenon in New Zealand, you know.
And 100%.
So I think it's
I feel like less so now. Like if you're on the show now, like it's so fragmented now in terms of what people are watching and how they're consuming different forms of media. But back then, you probably got the sort of tail end of
7 o'clock was the prime time slot, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was like Current Affairs or an Escape from Reality with Shortland Street.
Another hospital blowing up.
End of year cliffhanger every year. It seems. Wow, what an experience. Money good?
Yeah, look, I mean, I was 23, you know, like, I was 20, I mean, I don't know how, I probably shouldn't say how much I was earning, but it was...
That's 10 years ago, you can say if you want.
Well, it was like, you know...
Like 100 grand, at least.
It was six figures, so, like, for 23 in 2015, that's good money for me, you know, I was like...
It's good money for anyone, mate.
Not only that, but I was just proud, like, I was just very proud of myself, because I'd done what I wanted to do, I'd done... my goal, you know, I was like, I want to be a working actor, and it was happening, and I was very happy to be doing it, and I was on set every day, and I was working a craft, and some of the, you know, like, some of the storylines frustrated me a bit, but you can't have, I mean,
it's what it is,
every day, you know, that, so, but, it was great, and more than that, like, for the first time, I think my dad realised that I could take this seriously as a career, and so that was a big moment for our relationship. I think is he became proud, and it just kind of set me up, you know. So it set me up and allowed me to not be struggling. So that, but it was almost harder, because then I went from that, and then when I went back to LA to being a broke actor, it was like, fuck, you know, I felt like I was regressing. So it was almost bad to do it that way. Like you kind of want to just keep going up and keep making more and more money, but to go from, you know, a nice cushy lifestyle, and then, but it was great, man. It was great. I have nothing but fond memories, and I mean, sure, I could have done things differently. I probably would have stayed on a bit longer.
Did you leave on your own terms, or were you?
Yeah.
Just thought the time was right after 3 years. It's hard though, isn't it? Because it's like it's probably like me with radio to a degree. It's like I was at the same station for 20 years, and you realise. You're missing like a golden cell in a way. And I feel like I haven't had him on the podcast yet, but I'd love to get Michael Galvin on at some point.
Oh, yeah, you should.
It must be the same sort of situation. Like, you start acting with this dream to be like a Hollywood leading man or whatever it happens to be. And then you get this good money, you get a taste of it, and it's intoxicating. So how did you turn your back on it after 3 years?
So they tried to extend. They wanted to extend my contract, and I believe, if my memory's right, it was like to 5 years. And they wanted to do it by that, and then do subsequent years after that. But I think they were angling like my character and Bella to get hitched and to have quite a large storyline and be quite a you know, key component to the show. And looking back, I probably regret not staying on and doing 5 years, because I think one, just to do more work, and two, would have set me up a lot better financially, and just also I was still green. I was 20 fucking three. So I think I wasn't a man yet, and even though I thought I was, but with radio, I just felt like I always had these dreams of the kind of work I wanted to do, and that doesn't necessarily mean I just thought sometimes I was being underused, and I felt like I had a lot more potential and a lot more skill set to be able to show dramatically, and I just didn't feel like I was doing that. And I think I wanted to do more. I was just like, man, I'm getting really itchy here. Like, I either need more something to sink my teeth in, or I need to just
you need take to be challenged
risk.
More.
Yeah. Or I need to leave the show and risk and try and get what I'm looking for somewhere else. Mm. And I'd gone over to LA and had some successful meetings over there, and then just decided, probably a bit too hot-headedly, that I wanted to leave and go to LA.
There'd be nothing worse than dying wondering, eh? or dying with regrets.
Exactly. Yeah. But to be honest, 5 years wouldn't have hurt me at all. When I talked to my dad about it at the time, he said, look, you need just do it. Do 5 years. What's the worst? There's no harm in doing that. And he was right. In retrospect, he was definitely right. But I did what I did. I was young. I was a bit naive and a bit dumb and a bit arrogant, whatever. And left and took that risk. And it took years for that risk to pay off. But at the same time, you go through that calculated risk that didn't work. I learned and fucking grew so much.
Mm.
I really fucking was in the thick of it at for those years. And I think that's where I did my biggest learning and biggest growth as both a person and as an actor, and went back to the drawing board. In LA, I went back to drama school. I went back to acting classes. I really went back to craft work and all that and really tried to work out. But at 25, 25 when I left, still a boy, And I should have really just incubated myself in that environment until I was becoming a man in my later 20s. Mm. Because even now, like at 32, I feel like I'm just breaking through into manhood and also being a leading man. Like, now is my time where I'm now coming into that leading man phase. Because as a male actor, and casting wise, in your mid 20s is really awkward because you're too old for the Disney stuff or the kid stuff. You're too old to be high school kid.
Yeah.
But you're too young to be like, you're not going to take a leading man role at 25. Like,
and what, no one's going to take you seriously.
No one's going to take you seriously. You're going to get your ass kicked. Like, so it's like you don't look like a man. You don't have the life experience of a man. So, look. Yes, I regret it in some ways, but at the same time, I also feel like, man, when I went to hell, I came out a lot stronger, and I forged myself a lot stronger through all those trials and tribulations, and that has really ultimately defined who I'm carrying through as now, and so now I feel very ready for those leading man roles. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Well, let's chat about your dad for a bit, because you mentioned him. So your parents were, and probably rightfully so, I suppose, apprehensive about this career choice?
Yeah, as you would. I mean,
you're from Hawke's Bay. I'm from Palmerston North, just up the road. It's the same sort of thing. You want to be an actor? What the fuck are you on about?
There's no career in that. I mean, New Zealand, let alone Hawke's Bay. New Zealand, it's not really a career path. But fucking, let alone small towns, Hawke's Bay. So it's not even a thought. So it was a bit wild, but...
When you got the job on Shortland Street, they must have been like, oh, thank God, okay. That's the pinnacle of New Zealand in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. I think so, and I think... my mum, she was always supportive. She was happy that I was just doing what I wanted to do, but I think Dad was more obviously practical and...
Pragmatic, for sure. Pragmatic. For sure, yeah.
Was like, I don't want my son being broke. So, I don't want him to struggle in life, So I think he was just coming – it came from a place of love, but it was pragmatic.
Mm. And I suppose from your parents' perspective, when you've got a son that's got a major role on Shortland Street, suddenly it's like tangible proof of what you're doing.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like their friends will start commenting about it. That brings an element of pride and stuff, I guess.
100%. Yeah.
And then, so your dad, Graham, so when did he pass away?
He passed away at the end of 2015. So, right at the end of 2015.
Fuck, so how old were you at the time?
Like, so 25.
Right.
Yeah, so that was the end of my first year in LA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm, so, yeah, what was his cause of death?
Yeah, so he was having some heart problems, and he was very dogmatic, so he never liked hospitals, he never liked getting treatment.
Apart from Shortland Street.
apart from Shortland Street.
Sorry. No, it was a nice moment. I fucked it up.
Well, I'm sure he would have enjoyed, you know, being treated by the nurses at Shortland Street as well. But no, he was having some heart problems and he didn't want to, he left it quite late and kind of put it off and whatever, and it got to a point where he had to go to hospital, he had keyhole heart surgery, which is a pretty standard operation for heart problems. Hated hospitals, absolutely hated them. But he had the surgery, it was a success, and then he was obviously in an induced coma, and the doctor gave him too much blood thinner, and then that blood thinner caused a brain bleed, and then straight away it was just like 24 hours. You know, it was just like, so once he got the brain bleed, he was basically a vegetable, and they called us and was just like, look, you know, we're going to keep him on life support and until you can all say goodbye, and then, but there's no fixing it, unfortunately. So it was very sudden, and it was just really tragically ironic, you know, because he hated hospital, didn't want surgery, survived the surgery and got through and came out on the other side, and then they just overdid it on the blood thinner.
Were you angry at the time?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, because
is there anything you can do about it, or is it just like, sorry, my bad?
It's just sorry. You know, they call you. We got called into this weird kind of room, and then the head surgeon or whatever he is, he kind of says, look, on behalf of the hospital, sorry. And it's like, cool.
It's not really good.
Well, yeah, no, it's not, but at the same time, you know, it's a hard one. It's a hard one to wrangle because, you know that the public health system is so fucking overworked, but you also, which makes me angry at that as well, because I'm like, man, if they have fucking enough rest, this is a human error. You know, so what do we do to stop this? Because this is obviously costing lives, and it's like, we're not talking about a car here. We're talking about
a life.
And affecting people's entire fucking lives and families. So I was quite angry, but at this, you know, me being angry or at the doctor or at the hospital wasn't going to bring them back. So it doesn't matter if I swear at them or, you know. I'm not going to hit them, but you know, there's nothing that's going to do anyway. So it was kind of like probably a massive moment of realizing that there are things out of my control.
Can you remember your last conversation with your dad? I guess you didn't know. I don't know. Like from sitting here, like you hope it's going to be something like poignant or profound. But I suppose not knowing he's going to pass, it was probably something mundane.
Yeah, I'll never forget that conversation.
Really?
Yeah, I was driving. I was working as a front of house for a nightclub in LA, and I was driving because I remember the exit, and I remember talking to him on the freeway and stuff, and it was before he went in for the surgery, and he was waiting, and I was really upset because I was getting worked up, and I was saying, look, I don't want you to die. Like, you've got to come out of this. Like, I want to make sure that, you know, I can talk to you, and I want to make sure that, you know, you're there for my kids, and you can be a granddad, and blah, blah. And he was reassuring me, no, it's going to be okay, and it'll be fine. Like, I'm fine. Everything's going to be fine. And then just as we're about to hang up, he said, oh, just remember, always be a leader, never be a follower. And then for the first time since I was a kid, he said, I love you and I'm proud of you. And it was weird because it was like, first of all, I hadn't heard those words come out of his mouth. And since I was young. And it's not that I didn't know it's not that he didn't love me. It's just he was very old school. And it was just weird. It was almost ominous that he said that, because it was almost like he knew. Because otherwise he wouldn't – it felt like he wanted to be at peace by saying that and making sure that I knew that before he went. Because I feel like if he knew he was going to survive, he wouldn't have said that, because he would have been confident in the fact that he'd be able to live to see another day and tell me that at another time. But it was just – when he said that, I got a real sinking feeling, and I just – yeah, it was better just to hear those words, and, you know, it just, yeah, it really, obviously I was crying in the car, and those were literally the last words he said to me.
Fuck, what a great last conversation, though.
Yeah.
With the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah.
So, yeah, left nothing out there. So, I mean, I know actions speak louder than words, but words are also pretty special as well. If you got the actions and they're backed up with words, so you got the words, and you got the words that he was, you know, okay with the job you were doing.
Yeah, because that year in LA had been really fucking hard, and I'd come close on a couple of things, like literally down to the final two on a couple of things, and you know, when you're looking at a contract for $30,000 US an episode, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, and this was back in 2015, and that was on the lower pay scale, and you know, and so every time I get through these final rounds, obviously he's there, he's saying, yeah, you go get it, you know. So he was here in my back, and then when it didn't fall through, he'd say, just get back on the horse, mate, like it's all good, like you just go, you got that close, you'll get it again. But so this happened a few times, and then when he went in for the surgery, I ended up, he was in a coma for a week, and in that time I'd booked a commercial, which was my first acting job in the States, and so it was a big deal for me, and it paid really well, and so I was stoked, and I couldn't wait. He was due to come out of his coma the day I finished the commercial, and I remember coming off set and being really excited, and to tell him about the set and tell him about the, you know, everything, because he didn't know that I was going for it, he didn't know I got it, so I couldn't wait for him to wake up and me be like, yeah, I fucking booked my first job in LA, blah blah blah. And then I walked off set, and I had all these missed calls from my sister, and I thought, oh fuck, this is weird, and picked up, and I was obviously on cloud nine, and picked up the phone, called her, and she's obviously screaming down the phone and saying that I needed to come home, and oh, dad was dead, and so I just fucking, I remember being in a parking lot and just fucking falling on my knees, and just I've never wept like that, eh? It's a guttural fucking sound, you know, like it's just like your body, yeah, it just releases, you know, and I just, your whole world just stripped from you, and so it was the worst, that next 24 hours, because I just got on the first flight back, and man, I obviously didn't sleep on the plane, but you're just numb, you know, you're going through customs, you're numb, no one on the plane knows what you're going through, and obviously, and you don't expect them to, but you're just numb, you can't watch a movie, because you're just waiting to be transported to your dead father. Yeah,
literally just like treading water or biding time.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man. How old was your dad?
He was 61.
Right.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, so still too young.
Yeah, incredibly much. Yeah. I'm sorry that you had to go through that.
Yeah, thank you, yeah.
But that last conversation, fuck, that's special.
Very special. Yeah, I'll never forget. I can still see and taste and hear everything in that moment, eh? Yeah,
and there was a quote I read from you in an interview somewhere, talking about your dad. You said, "I feel like I became a man that day. I had to, for my family and for dad."
Yeah, yeah. It's incredible. Once you don't realize how much a father holds the family together until they're gone, and that. I didn't realize how quickly things would unbalance without that patriarchal figure, you know, and trying to step into that, but also not trying to be my father was a weird thing, you know, like not trying to be my father as the father of the family, but trying to fulfill certain roles or things that he took care of, and there was a hard...
Like in terms of like looking after your mum or your siblings or...
Well, he was just a source of strength, I think, for everybody and looking after my mum and my sister and, it just really made me realise how much he actually did without doing, you know?
Mm.
Like it was kind of unspoken or unsaid and you just took it for granted until he was gone and it just felt like the whole balance just went like that. And it just, you know, the whole family dynamic really changed. And it was a rough period for my family for a few years. I mean, there's still some stuff that is being mended now. It hasn't been easy. Yeah, so.
It's hard, eh? Like, everyone wants life to be like neat and simple and perfect, and it's just not. And, you know, sometimes bad things happen and you've been the master of that yourself, but then there's things like this that just happen to everyone and we're going to have to deal with it at some point, like illness or death or whatever, and it's hard. Life's complicated.
Yeah, on top of normal life.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So let's zoom in on the LA stuff for a while. So you had something like 150 auditions over a couple of years?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. So before I booked my first gig, not the commercial, the Dolly Parton film. It was I always wrote down what auditions I had, and
like a journal or a diary,
and I had counted 152 since when I got booked.
Something. It's a lot of rejection.
It's a lot of rejection, and some of them were almost worse because you got so close, and then got rejected. So, you know, you go on for that final audition where it's you and the girl or the co-star, and right before you head in, and then by that stage you're going to have the, you know, cameras on you and everyone's in the room and all that kind of stuff, and before you go in, you look at the contract, you look at the money, you sign it, and then you walk in and do the audition. I'm just like, that's just torture, man. Like, this is life changing money. This isn't like, you know, Shortland Street was great, but this is actually life changing money. This will change my life. You know, 10 episodes at X amount. You know, and it's like, this will change my life drastically. I'll be able to buy, you know, property in LA. I'll be able to do this. I'll be able to, you know, like you start daydreaming. You go, oh fuck, I can finally
Mustang.
That's what you do because you're going, and you're 10 minutes away from that. That could happen in the next 10 minutes. So like to have that weight on you and to try not to let that rattle you, and then you find out that they wanted, you know, that you were perfect, but they wanted blue eyes. And you're like, oh, what about contacts? You know,
I'll find a solution.
Find a solution. But so many times like that came down to little tiny things, and then, you're just in the whim, and that's the problem with the career is that there's so much out of your control, which as a control freak, I find really difficult.
Yeah, that's gonna be. I mean, you do something like something that you're into, like Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and the more you do it, you get better.
Yeah.
And the harder you work, the better you get, the more success you get. But something like this, it's like so many variables that are just completely out of your hands.
Well, that's why I love Brazilian jiu-jitsu, because it's so black and white. You can't bullshit. You can't talk your way out of it. You can't talk your way up. You know, like it's just like it is. The better person will be
always
better.
Always.
There's no doubts about it. You can't talk smack. You know, like you're going to get found out. If you say that you're a black belt, or you say that you've won this and then that, it's going to happen. You're going to find out really quickly. Whereas like in acting, people, you know, they'll say whatever they want to say because no one checks them on it. You know, and there's a lot of like airy-fairiness in that industry. So that's why I find martial arts in general is very refreshing, because it's like you can't talk smack and you can't lie. You know, so it's like, That's what I love about it. But it's just learning to relinquish that control, you know.
Yeah. So the Dolly Parton movie, that was like a Christmas movie, and you played the uncle of young Dolly.
Yes.
I believe that went really well too. Yes. And they were looking at doing a series afterwards.
Yeah. So we sat around when Dolly was like 10.
Yeah.
And I played her uncle. So in her life, her uncle sort of saw her talent and was like, I need to do something about that. And that was what the whole film was about, was him just kind of discovering her, and then her, her parents, well, her dad didn't want her to leave, you know, and go off and be an entertainer. And so her uncle had to try and convince her dad, blah, blah. And then that didn't really get resolved by the end of the film. And so then they were going to, if it went well, they were green lighting a series that would be Dolly and Bill, Uncle Bill on the road. And so that was what I was really looking forward to, was this kind of journey. Because that's when she went on like the Porter Wagoner show and started picking up and getting all these like radio shows and TV spots and all that. And then it goes off and then she just takes off. So that show would have been really interesting. And obviously, again, life-changing, because the movie was great, but it was a one-off film. And so when they said, look, if this gets X amount in ratings, the series will go ahead. And you're going to be a lead in the series to Dolly, and it's like, cool. I'm going to be a lead in a TV series. You know, that's literally life changing. You know, career changing, life changing. Like, and this is NBC, one of the biggest networks in America, in the world. And so that again, you're starting to go, far out. What am I going to buy? You know, what should I get? You know, this and this. But also, you're going, what a gift as an actor. Like, I can, because TV series like that are just an absolute, that's the dream, because you can just work out this character arc over a 10 episode series or whatever and really play with that character and stretch those boundaries a bit. But the ratings went off the charts. Like, it beat Empire, and it beat all the shows that were just doing really well at the time. And so the ratings couldn't have been better. You know, I think that they had 4 million views on one night and ended up having 12 million views all throughout the nights they did it or something. And so couldn't be better ratings-wise. And then so I remember the producer saying to me, this is going to go ahead. It's going to get greenlit. And so I came back to New Zealand for summer holidays, and I was like, I'm going to have the best summer. And then when I go back, get on that plane, I'm going back to a fucking awesome job. Before I get on the plane to go back, I get a call from the producer, and he's like, look, I'm really sorry, but the studio is the network has just decided it's not going ahead. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, what about the ratings? He's like, I know, but like, this is the thing, you don't know why. I don't know. My theory is that at that time, darker shows were all in the rain. Yeah, it was like, you know, Game of Thrones, it was Empire, it was all these really dark, kind of like bitter kind of shows. And I think at the time people liked that for whatever reason, and now we want lighter shows because we're in a dark period ourselves. So
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
You know, so I think at that point in 2016, 2017, you know, life was pretty good, so I think people enjoyed the darker stuff, whereas now I think it would probably be a different story and probably be the opposite. And so Dolly's obviously a beautiful human being, and her show was wholesome and light and all that, so I don't think the wholesome vibe was the thing, but it just blew my mind because the ratings couldn't have been better. So I don't know, but you know, you're literally, someone wakes up and makes a decision that affects thousands of people, and you know, so it's so hard to grasp, because I was like, not only like my life definitely would have changed, but what about the crew and all that? So you do go, man, there's so many moving parts to this industry that you just, it's not because I stuffed up, you know, because usually, like, in life, you know, something doesn't go ahead because I made a mistake, or I fucking did this, or I did that, but it had nothing to do with me, which is kind of good, but at the same time, you're like, what can I do? Can I do something? You know, like, please just green light this show, you know, because you are going to drastically change my life.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's very selfish to think that at the same time.
Yeah, you know? But it's got to be so frustrating, eh?
It was. And so I went back to LA and was a broke actor again.
Well, at least you were very experienced for that role.
Yeah, I know.
How broke did you get? So you went over there with some Shortland Street cash?
Yeah.
Were you quite good at saving and budgeting?
Yeah, I've always been good at saving. Yeah.
So you went over there with a bit of cash in the bank. Did you manage to get by on that, or were you working as a waiter? Or?
Fuck, I was... No, I worked at this club for a little bit. I worked under the table as a handyman. I met a Kiwi over there who did up apartments and things. And
oh, yeah, well, I went on a deep dive into your on your Instagram. So I was going to bring this up because you've shared a lot on Instagram. So you were flatting with a dude And it was really weird. You caught him filming you as you were sleeping one day?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Far, yeah.
And this leads us to the Kiwi guy.
So I basically packed my, like, we had a bit of a fisticuffs in the apartment. And then I was, and then I packed my bags and left.
So was he filming you sleeping?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah,
and you was, caught him filming you sleeping? Or you saw a video of
caught,
it?
I caught him.
Shit. And why? What was this? You sleep nude on top of the duvet? What?
It was. We're talking about Hollywood, man. It's, right. It's
the American dude.
Interesting character. Oh yeah. But just some weird characters there. You know? So like, I mean, a lot of fringe people go there. You know. So it's. But I mean, that was the end. That was it for me. And then so I stormed out. But I was like, fuck, I have nowhere to live. And then this guy was doing up the apartments nearby, and he's like, What's the matter? Why are you packing your bags? And I'm like, I've left. I kicked out. This guy's filming me. We had a bit of a fisticuffs. And he's like, oh, fuck, all good. We'll sort you out. What are you doing now? I was like, well, fuck, I've got acting class in bloody 30 minutes. And he's like, okay, just leave your bags here. And blah, blah. I was like, oh, fuck, now I'm going to get robbed. And so I went off to acting class. And then I came back pretty miserable. And then by that, I came back. And there was this empty apartment that he was doing up. And he had moved all my stuff in, and he had fully furnished it with stuff that he had taken from other apartments that he was doing up. So I had, like, basics, you know, couch, and he had taken a TV, and he had wired the cable from the neighbors, and so I could cable TV and stuff, and he gave me a bed and all that. But he had fully finished this. He borrowed a spare fridge from someone, fully finished this apartment for me, and goes, live here as long as you need to, you know, and just don't even worry about, like, just pay us a little bit of rent. But because he was doing it up, he didn't care. So he was just,
is your immediate reaction sweet as, or is it like, okay, what's the cost? What's the price personally? Like, what's the ulterior motive?
Not for that, because he you know, that just gut instinct of,
yeah.
My gut instinct was, this guy is just purely genuine. Like, right. This is a very genuine guy, and like, I was just blown away by his generosity. And he goes, look, just pay us a little bit of rent, and you can do some work for me as well. And I was just like, mate, yeah, of course.
Mm. Was that the Kiwi guy?
Yeah. Right. So he's from Waipawa, and he used to, so crazy was, he used to drink at my dad's pub. So it was just like, it was quite a weird connection.
Yeah, because I suppose when, yeah, if it was an American dude, you'd be like, okay, what's going on here?
Yeah.
But if it's another Kiwi, you immediately assume the best.
Yeah, not only a Kiwi, but from Waipawa. Like, right. We're talking about as salt of the earth as it gets, you know? So so it was awesome. And I was just like, man, this is like those moments in life where you're just like, cool. You know, like, it was such a cool outcome to a shitty situation. But that stuff happened to me all the time, Tom. Like, what, mate, I got... One time I was driving back from work as a handyman. I'm covered in fucking plaster. I stop at the stoplights, and this guy rolls up next to me, and he's in like a nice Audi SUV. His shirt, he looks like your classic like accountant or something. You know, he's like a nice shirt on, you know, whatever. Really well groomed. Winds down the window, and he's going to listen to me. And I was like, what the fuck? So I put down my window. He's like, hey, are you a model? And I was just like, nah. And he's just like, oh, do you want to be? And I was just like, I don't know, man. Why? And he's just like, pull over after the lights. And I was just like, oh, okay. Oh, if I can pull over, get out of the car. And I kind of meet him halfway between the cars. I was like, what's up? How can I help you? And he's like, are you a model? And I was like, no, I'm not. And he's just like, well, I can. Do you want to be one? I can help you. And I was just like, what do you mean you can help me? Are you an agent or something? Are you a scouter or something? And he's just like, no, but you know, I could get you some modeling work. And I was like, okay, like what? Like print or what are we talking here? And he's like, oh, it would be private. And I was just like,
okay, creepy.
What do you mean private? And he's like, look, I'm not gonna waste. He said something to the effect, you know, I'm not gonna beat around the bush. And he's like, he had a wedding ring on, by the way, and he's like, and he told me he had kids as well. And I was just like, so anyway, after the small talk, he's like, would you be interested in dancing for me? And I was like, sorry? He's like, would you be interested in dancing for me like once a week? I was like, what do you mean fucking dancing for you? He's like privately, naked. And I was like, pardon? He's like, I'll give you, his first offer was $1,500 US.
Jeepers.
To dance. And he's like, but I was like, no. And he's like, oh, okay, but
you didn't even hesitate.
Dude, fuck no.
Yeah.
He's like, what about $2,000? And I was like, no. He's like, but there'll be no touching. And I was like, I don't give a fuck, mate. Like, so you're going to watch me strip? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, and what happens in this fucking session? And he's like, well, I won't be allowed to touch you. And I was like, but what, you can fucking jack off? He's like, well, yeah, I will jack off. And I was like, excuse me? He's like, yeah, but it won't touch you. And I was like, mate, you're not fucking selling this thing. And then he's like, he's like, what about $3,000? And he went up to $3,500. And $3,500.
And then you said yes.
And then the rest is history. And then I moved into no. But I was just like, no, mate. Wow. I was like, no. I was like, I'm sorry, mate, but no amount of fucking money I'll fucking do that for. I'm sorry. Like, I can't fucking do it. And he's like, okay, well, here's my number in case you change your mind. Gives me his number on the fucking piece of paper. And then he tells me, he's like, what about, would you sell me your underwear?
You said yes to this.
No, sorry, this is a regret because he goes, I was like, my undies? And he's like, yeah, I'll give you $150 per pair. Oh, and I was like, what, mate, you don't want my undies. I was like, oh man, I work as a handyman during the day. I sweat all day, and then I go to jiu-jitsu. Like, these are not undies that you want, mate. These are, they'll fucking stink. And he's like, yeah, the dirty. he's like, the dirtier, the better. And I was just like, you are fucking cooked, mate. And he's full immaculate fucking accountant professional. And yeah. I was just like, blowing my mind. Wedding ring. I was just like, what is the. Nothing's making sense right now. So anyway, but I regret that because what I should have done was say yes, gone to the op shop, got some fucking undies, and then sold it for $150. But I didn't.
I live and learn. Was there not? Was it? They're not like one slither of you. Okay, so you're broke. You're struggling in LA. You're not sure where the next paycheck's coming from. When it gets up to $3,000, not even a tiny part that's like, oh, I could probably. What's the worst that could happen? You know, you think, okay, if he tries anything, I could defend myself again.
No. Because the image, that would haunt me for the rest of my days. Mm. It doesn't matter how much money, like, the image of him blowing his load while I'm stripping on a Friday night in his bedroom or whatever, That would haunt me for the rest of my days. Yeah. And, you know, and all, like, fuck, if you want to do it, all good. All the power to you. I'd know, whatever. But for me, I was like, there's no way that in the future when I have a son and he's asking and I'm trying to teach him to be a man in the world that I can look him in the eyes and, like, give him some advice and say that with you know, integrity when I've fucking done that for $3,000. You know, there's no way I can raise a son and be like, hey man, look, this is how you walk as a man in this world, blah, blah, blah. And then fucking have this memory of some guy blowing his load, you know? And for me, it was a no brainer. It was just like, no, this is a short term, it'll be a short term gratificational fix, you know? I've the $3,000, awesome. Fuck, there's my rent for the month. But like, in long term, I think the long term effects or
the trade off.
Yeah, no, it wasn't worth it, you know? Yeah. I was like, yeah, and look, maybe I was wrong. Maybe fucking my integrity wasn't worth it. I don't know. But for me personally, in that moment, and still to this day, I feel like I made the right decision.
Where do you think that comes from, the current you looking out for future you? Because I'm thinking, first of all, full disclosure here, like, I've never been handsome enough for someone to pull me over and offer me that sort of money so they can so I could dance for them. It's never happened. And
would you do it?
Well, how old were you at the time?
27.
I would like to look you in the eye and say, fuck no. But if I'd been in LA for a year and I was struggling and I was broke, maybe. If the offer presents, and I don't know. And I'm full of admiration for you for having this line in the sand, fuck no, never attitude. But I don't know. I'd like to say I would, but at the same age, I don't know if I would have.
Yeah, I don't know. Look, I don't know who's right or wrong. That's the thing.
Well, you are like on every level, like,
yeah, I don't know,
turning it down. It was moralistically everything. It was the right thing to do, and I'd like to think I'd demonstrate that same character, but I've never had fucking Ben Affleck good looks, you know.
Oh, fuck, thank you. No, I don't know about that, but yeah, no, it's, yeah, I don't know. It just that's just how it was, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, how you do anything is how you do everything, you know. So I feel like that's a slippery slope, because then you're going, oh, well, fuck, what else could I do for a bit of fucking cash, you know? Well, maybe I'm, you know, so
yeah, that's the thing. Once you've crossed that line, once you've opened that door, I'd agree.
Yeah, yeah, and it's, and that town, you know, it's full of that. That town is full of people who are leveraging themselves to get ahead and whatever. And, you know, all the power to them. Fuck, maybe they're working and I'm not. So I don't know. Maybe I did make the mistake, but I'd like to think that you can do it the right way and with your morals intact, and I'm a firm believer that I can and I am, you know, and I will.
Yeah. You shared that on, actually, both those stories, you shared them on Instagram. I think it was like January or February 2019. There was like a bunch of like really nice black and white photos of you in the water, and then all these incredibly like vulnerable and personal posts that you shared. Why was that? Was it like a theme month or anything? Was it a phase you were going through?
My sister shot those. She's a beautiful photographer, and she's very talented. And she was interested in doing something like that. And I think at that time, 2019, just come back from LA, and so I was in a very reflective mood, and I was in a very, not healing, but I was trying to work out or navigate my way back from LA. And so I went back to Hawke's Bay and for a year, and just tried to reground myself and try and settle myself a bit, because I felt really all scattered and stuff. And I think I said to her, I said, look, I'd be interested in kind of doing these shots and pairing them with honest stories, because I felt like, one, Instagram is never honest, you know, like a lot of
it's completely curated.
Yeah. So it's only the side. And I felt like it's only ever the side that you want people to see. And especially in my industry, it's always the good and it's always the positives and the good stories and all that. And I felt like maybe I could be a bit honest about, because everyone thinks, you know, LA, it's all good. But like, I was like, there's the stories in the side of LA or actors going to LA that you don't see, and that a lot of people don't want to talk about, and a lot of because it's hard, you know, because it fucking beats you down, and a lot of people don't want to talk about that side of it. But I just felt like maybe it was a bit therapeutic for me to express the truth of what I went through there. And
that's a great series of posts.
I've always wondered whether I should delete them, or whether I shouldn't have been that honest, and whether there's, you know, it's better to be a bit, keep things to yourself a bit more. But I never wanted to sugarcoat LA or to be like, you know, because it was a rough time, and I had a rough time, and I just wanted to be honest about it. You know, it's just like, because that is a reality for though there are tough stories out there, you know. But
yeah, I've got another one here. This is from February 2019, same sequence of photos. One of my good friends had just committed suicide. I was off to settle a 2-year legal battle. My birthday was a week away, and then my girlfriend left me out of the blue. Some weasel club owner offered her a trip to Greece and wined and dined her. I don't hold a grudge. In a world of endless choices and upgrades, I hope she picked the right one. My only regret is letting go of the ones who had treated me better. First of all, sorry about you. Sorry about your mate.
That was a tough time. First I'd lost my dad, then my granny, who I was very close to. My granny and I were very close. Then my papa, so my granddad. Then Pua Magasiva committed suicide. So he died. And then Pip, a friend of mine who was also my girlfriend at one point, she committed suicide. And it was just like, by that point, I just lost so many people. I was just like, in a short amount of time. This was all within probably 9 months. I was just numb. Like when I got told, I think Pip was the last one. I remember just feeling numb, and I almost like didn't get upset straight away, because I was just like, I didn't know I didn't know how to take it anymore. You know, by that point I was just like, I don't even know how to take this news. And so it wasn't until I think a day later that I just broke down and started crying because it took that long for my body to process it all. But then there was that, and then I forgot about that, and then the girlfriend left me, and you know, and I was so vulnerable at that point, you know, and insecure, and because obviously I was struggling in LA and trying to make, and I wasn't, you know, at a point where I was working as the handyman and stuff, but I was feeling very insecure, and then that happened, and she left me for a guy with money, so that fucked me up, and I was just like, fucking hell, you know, this is
it's a lot.
Doesn't really get worse. I was can it get worse? I don't fucking know anymore. Like, you know, I thought my dad dying was the worst it would get, but no. So keep rolling the punches, and I think at that point I just went, fuck it. What else have you got for me? Fuck.
Mm.
You know, like, it was just the worst fucking roll of punches, to be honest. Mm. And just to have that person, you know, your girlfriend or your partner to blindside you like that.
How long were you together?
A year.
Right.
But to, like, you know, at that moment, for her to leave at that moment, like, because she knew about my friend, you know, my friend committing suicide and the other people in my life that had died and all that. So she was there for me, all that. And, you know, it was the week of the last person committing suicide that she left me. It was in that week. And I was just like, how?
What are you doing?
And not only that, but the day before she admitted to it that she was off with this dude, that she'd run off, she called me, and she'd been with her family and her nieces and nephews and stuff. And she had talked about, she was like, oh, she was talking about how much she wanted kids with me, and she wanted to move back to New Zealand with me and start a family and stuff. And I was like, amazing. And then 2 days later, boom, done. Just, you know, and I was just like, nah, fuck this.
Crazy. How's your mental health been over the years? You seem like a really resilient guy. I don't know if that's something that you've always had or that you've had to develop over the years with this industry that you've chosen, but your mental health mostly been good?
I don't think so.
No?
Resilient is key, and jiu-jitsu has helped me a lot. Look, my mum wanted me to go to therapy, and you know, she thought I should after my dad died, and after all this stuff, I probably should have, but I didn't want to, because, and this is probably quite a controversial thing to talk, and I'd love to talk to more men about mental health, because I think it's important. It's really hard as a Kiwi male to talk about it. You know,
yeah, it is. I feel like we're getting better, but I'm older than you. I'm 50 now, and I was from a generation where you didn't show any sort of vulnerability. Actually, you're probably the same, Hawke's Bay, in the 90s, early 2000s. You don't show any sort of weakness, because it could be weaponized against you. Or...
But the problem was, is that I felt like therapy doesn't help. Like, again, probably going to divide a few people on this, but I don't think therapy for men helps, because for me, I don't think men seek validation for their feelings. I don't want someone to validate my feelings and go, oh, so you did, because they don't have the solution. And that's my problem with, that was my problem with therapy, is that they're not going to give me a magic bullet or a solution. Yes, it's nice to talk about my feelings, but to be honest, I'd rather sit down with a very good friend of mine, you know, a guy mate, and talk to him. I would rather that, as opposed to paying someone $300 an hour for them to tell me, yeah, you're right.
Although they do, as someone that has been there and does swear by it, they give you a different way of, like, framing things and looking things. I'll give you another example. I could get up on stage next to you and someone hand me a script, and I'll read it and pretend to be someone else. And then you get up and you've had years of training, years of experience, years of hard knocks. You know what to do. You're trained and you're qualified. Mm. So sitting down and talking with a good friend, I agree, that's fucking great. But they don't know necessarily the right thing to say, or they can't. And unless you've got a really, really wise friend, but they probably can't. But therapists are good at saying, you know, okay, what about this? And then it gives you a different way of looking at it.
I understand
the cost is very prohibitive for a lot of people. If you're down to your last 300, you know.
And look, the cost isn't an issue, but it's more just, I felt like if they're not going to give me a solution, then I just feel like, one, it's time, and time is valuable, and two, it's money, and three, it's really just going to give me another way to look at it rather than the problem solve. But you're probably right, and look, I should probably give it a go. But I always felt like jiu-jitsu was my therapy.
Yeah.
Because, which probably isn't right as well, but, and I'm not saying I'm fucking right either.
No, so no, no. Please don't take that. No, honestly, it's an incredibly safe space here. There's no right or wrong, but you've got to, like, you got to fend for yourself when it comes to your mental health, and you got to work out what tools you need in your toolbox.
Mm.
If it's going in the sauna or going in an ice bath, great, but you got to work out what it is because no one else can do that for you.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't involve therapy, and if it doesn't, then that's fine too.
Yeah, look, and none of those, like, jiu-jitsu doesn't solve it either. Jiu-jitsu doesn't magically give me a solution, but what it does do is clears my head, gives me an outlet, it strips back to a primal level of survival, which is probably good in those times. Like, it stops the complications of overanalyzing, overthinking. It takes it right back to, like, level, you know, fight or flight. And also, you know, I obviously do saunas and ice baths as well, and all that stuff helps. And I've found through listening to guys like Goggins and Jocko Willink, like, that has helped me as well. Hearing those kind of guys talk about, because I still believe they're good at dealing. I mean, you know, they're SEALs, and so they've got a lot of trauma and stuff as well, but the way they deal with it is a lot different than to just, like, an outpouring of emotion. It's more of a practical approach of, like, and I kind of lean towards that a little bit more, but that's just me. I may be wrong. I'm open to new things. But
no, I love both those guys as well. Goggins can be a little bit hardcore, like, but
I think we need that. Like, yeah. I think we need that a bit more.
Mm.
You know, like, I think.
The thing I like about them is the level of personal accountability. Like, you've got to look after yourself. No one's coming to save you. You've got to save yourself. Have you always been quite resilient, or
I think since I got, you know, going full circle back to diabetes, type 1 diabetes, I think that taught me to be resilient, because that was really my first major knock, you know, and first thing that I went, oh fuck, I have to deal with this thing that I wasn't expecting to deal with. It's not something I can just push away. It's not something I can shelve. Like, I have to literally deal with this on a day-to-day basis. So how am I going to do this without playing a victim? And I never wanted to be a victim and be like, oh, fucking diabetes ruined my life. Just trying to be like, no, fucking, how do I deal with this? And so I think from that age, from 15, going, oh, fuck, well, this is how I can attack every problem, I guess. But I don't know, maybe, yeah, fuck. Well, I think my dad was very resilient too, so maybe that, just getting those genes maybe or something like that. But again, I don't think I'd be in this industry if I wasn't resilient, because...
Oh, you have to be, don't you?
You have to be. So I think there's just a mix of everything that went on with my life that has just allowed me to be resilient. But fuck me, don't get me wrong. Like, I definitely have horrible days and, some dark days, and I've been down in some dark holes and stuff. And if I went to a therapist, I'm pretty sure they'd say that I've got depression. But
really?
Yeah, I reckon.
Yeah. Like... depression as in, like, a chemical balance, or...
Yeah, I think so.
Like, yeah, really?
Yeah.
Because I think I have like circumstantial depression.
Mm.
So there'll be major life upheavals. Yeah, like I've been through some fertility stuff and a marriage breakup, and I think that causes it. But I think for the most part, I'm pretty good. Mm. I don't know.
Mm.
How are you feeling today?
I wasn't feeling sharp yesterday.
Yeah.
But
just one of those days.
Yeah. Some of those days where you just the clouds seem a bit darker, and so trying to flip that and just be like, what? Why? You know, what are you? Let's look at some positives here. Let's look at the good things. And so just trying to be aware of myself and just kind of not catch myself out, but just kind of take a step back and go, okay, what are you feeling right now? What are you? Let's check in there. Why are you getting so agitated in this moment? Why are you taking it out on this person? So.
Yeah, is that how your depression looks? You just get frustrated?
Yeah. Well, and just withdraw, you know, just withdraw from people and things. And step one is awareness, right? So just being aware of my habits and going, oh, fuck, okay, why are you doing that today? You know, so, because there was nothing to be upset about yesterday. You know, there's no major thing went wrong, you know, whatever, you know. So, and that's why I like those guys like Jocko, because Jocko helps me see that, you know, like, his whole ethos in bad situations is to go good, you know? The car broke down, good, it does this, blah, blah, blah. You know, so it's like, so taking ownership, you know? So, yeah. And that helps me. That definitely has helped me. So, yeah, I've found that very useful, yeah.
Mm. Oh, that's good. Yeah, everyone's going through shit, hey? You just never know.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and that's part of growing up, as you kind of realise that.
Yeah, no one gets out of it scot-free. Everyone's going to deal through some stuff. And I think the more of a rich and fulfilling life you're living, the more like mistakes you're going to make, the more you're going to love people. And then when you lose them, it's going to fucking hurt.
Yeah.
But the only way to circumnavigate that is to lock yourself up, not have any meaningful relationships, don't take any risks in your life. And that's not even living your life.
But the flip side of that is those, you know, yes, things can go wrong, things do go wrong, but like when it goes right, it's fucking worth it all. Mm. You know, when relationships is like, man, if you, I could give up after the amount of failed relationships or whatever, but at the same time, when it works, man, that's the most beautiful thing ever.
Mm.
You know, when someone loves you and you love them, and there's fucking no other feeling like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's same with career, you know? Audition fucking sucks getting the call to say that you didn't get it or someone else got it or this person, the same. But, yeah, fucking sucks ass. But when you get that call to say that you got it, it's worth all those rejections. It's worth it all.
Yeah, Goggins talks about callousing your mind. You're definitely doing that with the auditions, aren't you?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Well, are you seeing anyone at the moment? Are you in love at the moment?
No, I'm not single.
Yeah. And happily single, not actively looking, or
no, I'm active. I would say I'm active. I'm definitely open. I'm definitely, I'm definitely ready for that stage of my life. I'm definitely ready. I really look forward to having a life partner and having a family with them and doing all that. Like it's something I really look forward to, and I hope that comes along soon. And
And what's next on the acting front?
So just doing, waiting for this film to come out, which is in 2 weeks, and just doing the promo work for that and just ensuring that, just waiting for that. And hopefully that does well and gets into some other film festivals around the world. And then from there, hopefully a bit of exposure and maybe that will, that will spruce up some interest in things. And,
Oh, that's at Home Kills.
Home Kills,
yeah. Yeah, it looks really good. I've seen the trailer online.
Yeah.
So what's the synopsis?
So, the synopsis. So it's
like a struggling butchery.
So it's two brothers who take over their dead father's home kills business. They're strapped for cash. The business is failing, and so they find themselves unwillingly. Well, they find themselves accidentally getting into a body disposal business. So they start getting rid of bodies and putting them through the meat grinder and turning them into dog rolls. And then from there, the two brothers are very different. So you've got Mark and Tom. Mark's all for this new venture. And in fact, he wants to get rid of people and now start killing people and disposing the bodies. And Tom, who I play, he doesn't want any part of it. But also it's bringing in money and helping them get the business back on track. And entwined and all that, there's a local gang and there's like a bit of a meth thing going on. So it's a really kind of it's dark, but it's funny. It's funny in parts. It's not slapstick funny. It's just more like
bleak comedy.
Yeah, more like Coen Brothers kind of comedy. Yeah. You know, so there's funny moments, but it's not trying to be funny.
Yeah.
It's funny because of the circumstances. It's small town New Zealand, so a lot of relatable characters and a lot of relatable issues and a lot of relatable kind of current events. Looking at that small town and just how dark and deep those small towns can kind of go.
And they really can.
They can.
Especially with the meth angle. Meth's huge in the small towns.
Yeah, and I just feel like the smaller the town, the deeper the secrets. Mm. And so
there's something in there.
So it's a very interesting look at that small town New Zealand life, and the cinematography is obviously beautiful, and cinematographer on that was amazing, and the shots alone are fucking amazing.
And it was real cheap, right? Like made for $250,000, which sounds like an alarming amount of money.
I think it was $300,000, but super low. But that's not much money at all. And what they did for that money. Incredible, you know, like they, that's that Kiwi ingenuity coming out, though, you know, that, that so
calling in favours from mates and
calling in favours. And that was one of the good things about doing it. And we shot it all around Matamata and Waikato. And that was one of the good things about doing it around there, because unlike Auckland, where it's a bit of a film scene, you'd go to the, we'd need to shoot at a pub, and the pub would just be like, yeah, all we want is a signed poster. And you can use the pub for the day. So cool. You know, and things like that, or yeah. Or extras. You know, everyone would do things for a box of beers or this or that. So you were able to do a lot more and stretch that budget out. And no one was making big money. Mm. Like, it was, you know, it's not like one person was making a whole lot of money. It was everyone really did above and beyond, like, work to make this happen. And that's why it felt so magical. Was like everyone believed in the story. Everyone believed in the project. And so you had all these people that would usually be getting paid a lot more, doing a lot more for less, and they were very happy to do it, because there was a real magic feeling while we were shooting, and I felt it, and everyone else had that same feeling, and it was just like we've got something really special here.
So it's got like a film festival release. Yeah, is it going to have like a broader release after that? What happens with film festivals?
I believe the way it works is, so we'll have the New Zealand International Film Festival. Then they'll do submit it to other film festivals. You have like Toronto, and there's like, you know, South by Southwest, all the big ones, Cairns and all that. You submit them to those, and then within this is how I think it works, my understanding of it, so I could be wrong. But from there, a distributor will see it. Well, you know, you'll try and shop it to distributors, and they're like, you know, the big studios and stuff, and they will purchase it from those film festivals and go, yep, we're going to buy it. So, like, they'll take the rights, and then they'll do a cinematic distribution. So it will do like Auckland, Wellington, Hamilton, kind of. It will do like all the whoever's involved in the International Film Festival, and then as well as the film festivals overseas, and then distributors will be at those film festivals and go, oh, fuck, we'll pay for this, for the rights of this. Mm. And then from there, that's when it explodes, because then, you know, who knows whether it's a streamer that picks it up and goes, yeah, we'll take it, or maybe a cinematic release, and they go, yeah, we'll pump it out to this many theatres throughout the world and blah, blah. So that's what we're trying to do, is generate, because if it does well, like if, you know, if it sells out and does well at the festival, gets a bit of heat, then that will prick the ears of the distributors up, and they'll be like, oh, fuck, well, let's look at this. Oh, fuck, this is pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Let's do that. I mean, that's happened time and time. You get Tyker's stuff, and, you know, so it's like...
Yeah, for sure.
So it's... That's what's exciting, is like it really does have potential. Like, I wouldn't have done it if I didn't believe in it, or didn't believe it had potential. So I haven't seen it. I'm super excited to see it. The shots alone, beautiful. The mood and the world of small town New Zealand, something I've always thought was not done enough. Mm. And just cool, you know, just very, very cool, dark but funny, you know, good moments. The people working on it were phenomenal. The actors, everyone really poured their hearts out into it.
So it's called Home Kills. What's your character's name?
Tom.
Tom. Tom definitely sounds like the sort of guy that would let someone jack off in front of him for money.
No, he's definitely not. He is a man of principle and moral. He is so straight. Yeah, yeah.
But he's killing people in the backyard.
Well, that's where. So that's the whole twist of the movie. Is okay. Tom starts. Yeah, so
he's struggling with
Tom's struggling with his moral compass, just like, you know, which I wasn't doing, but you know, but. Yeah, Tom struggles with his moral compass, and he's trying to feed. He's got a newborn on the way. He's got his partner that he's trying to take care of. He's got this psycho brother who's just an absolute wild card, who's just off the rails and just going off and doing shit and getting them in trouble. And, you know, he's doing shit with the gangs to piss them off. And so he's got to look after that. And so that's the struggle. And that's why I love the character, was that he kind of represents that Kiwi everyman of what we were just talking about with mental health. Mm. You know, this guy who would never talk to anyone about his health and just suppresses everything. And that's, you know, part of the film where it goes is, you know, you can only bubble under the surface so long before it fucking explodes, right?
Mm. Yeah, 100%.
So, and that's Tom. He's trying to keep his partner, you know, happy, and he's trying to provide for her. He's trying to provide for his newborn. He's trying to keep this crazy brother under wraps. He's He's got the failing business, so like, but he's always calm and collected because he is that Kiwi guy who's just good under pressure.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's that pressure that builds. That's what's interesting. Mm. He's like a, you know, that's a bit of a volcano there, you know.
What do you reckon your dad would make of all this? The movie that you're in now?
I think he'd love it.
Hey, yeah?
Yeah. I think he'd love it.
What would he make of this chat we've had today with you being so open and vulnerable about your mental health and your feelings? I don't know your dad from a bar,
so I'm just trying to imagine the conversation. He'd watch it. He would 100%. He'd probably call me up and just be like, "Yeah, that was a good interview. That was good. That was good. Yeah, it'd be you know." But that's enough. So he wouldn't dive into it or what? Yeah.
Elaborate.
Maybe mental health stuff. He'd go, "What's something going on? Is it?" Yeah, so. Maybe a bit of that, but mainly just be like, it was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder if, like that that last conversation you had with him, obviously it came from a place, from his perspective of, I don't know, fear or trepidation or nerves or whatever. But maybe it would have, like, set the platform for him so that he could be more open with his feelings about you. Because I feel like his generation sort of never, they were never allowed to sort of vocalise those things.
Yeah. And he came from... His father was super staunch, old school. Yeah, he was a captain in the Navy and very fucking hard on him.
Disciplinarian.
So yeah. So it was very ingrained in him, I think. So I think it's just kind of different generations, you know, different views on what a man should be and all that.
Yeah, and you can't have a chip on your shoulder about it because everyone's just doing the best they can with the information and resources they have.
Just
at the
like
time.
In 50 years' time, we'll probably look back. You know, people will look back at the way we act and be like, "Man, those guys, that's not how a man is." Or you know, so like, yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, it's always going to
evolve.
That's a part of life and human. You know, human nature is just to keep evolving and learning And that's why I don't get too worried about it, because I just think, you know, I fuck up and I've definitely made mistakes. But as long as I'm learning from them and being aware of those mistakes, that's growth, you know?
100, and you've got to keep making the mistakes. Yeah. You have to. And you said something before, like about, you know, you thought when you left Shortland Street and went to LA, you thought you were a man and you look back now and you weren't. As someone that's 50 sitting in front of you, I can tell you, like when you get to 50, you'll look back on this now and think, oh, I was a man then, but I... And I think that's the exciting thing. You never reach that point where it's like, I'm done. I know everything. And I think that's the exciting thing about life.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I think I'm looking forward to that. You know, I'm looking forward to reflecting on those moments and reflecting on how I am now and all that. But like, as long as I'm happy in the present and being present, that's important, you know, as long as I'm not trying to be something I'm not or I'm trying to...
Unless it's for a role, in which case you are.
Yeah. Then I'm getting paid to be someone I'm not. But, but, you know, as long as I'm being true to myself in the present, fuck, what more can you ask for?
Yeah. Oh, you're a good dude. I think your dad would be immensely proud.
Oh, thanks, Dom.
Thanks so much, Cam, for coming over today, and good luck for what the future brings. Hopefully it's fucking great things. You deserve it, man.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that.
not an industry for the faint.
No, it's not. For the crazy. It's slightly depressed.
Oh, we all are, mate. But you're aware of it, and I appreciate the insights today. You're a good man.
Ah, cool. Thank you, Dom. Thanks, appreciate Cam. It.
Thanks so much for listening all the way through this episode of Runners Only with Dom Harvey, and thanks again to my pals at Radix Nutrition for sponsoring this episode. If it's protein powders, smoothie recovery powders, or freeze-dried, just-add-water meals that actually taste nice and give you the nutrients you need, check them out, radixnutrition.co.nz. That's RADIX. Just before we go, you can reach me anytime on Instagram, DomHarveyNZ, or email me, DomHarveyNZ@gmail.com. I love getting your feedback in response to the podcast, good or bad. Actually, to be fair, it's only been good, and I genuinely thank you for that. Couple of housekeeping things before you go. If you feel like doing me a solid and you don't do this already, it would be epic if you could subscribe to the podcast. Subscribe or follow, whatever your platform allows. Most people listen to it without subscribing. Something like 20% of people subscribe. And I'm not actually sure what it does, but I've heard other people on way more successful podcasts asking their listeners to subscribe, so it must do something. I don't know.
Also, if you feel so inclined, it would be awesome if you gave the podcast a rating or review on whatever platform you're listening to this on, Spotify, Apple, whatever. Even better than that, share it on social media or share it with a friend who you think would enjoy it. All right, that's it for now. Thanks for your time. Genuinely appreciate having you along for this journey, and I really hope you enjoyed it. And I do hope to see you next time on Runners Only with Dom Harvey.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.